This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The IGSD team went to Kigali to help a whole series of countries understand what the challenges were, how they might meet them, and come out winners. We were among those dancing in the aisle at the end.
The Montreal Protocol that was signed in 1987 is widely regarded as one of the most important pieces of international cooperation on environmental issues. It created a phased ban on chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, the principal culprit of the so-called hole in the ozone layer, now greatly diminished due in large part to this agreement. Just this past weekend, nearly 30 years later, representatives from 140 nations gathered in Kigali, Rwanda, to amend the Montreal Protocol on substances that deplete the ozone layer. This time, the aim was to phase out the use of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, which don't affect the ozone layer, but are among the most potent greenhouse gases that humans produce. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk with one of the key figures behind the Montreal Protocol and Kigali Amendment, international environmental lawyer and founder of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development, Derwood Zelke. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Derwood Zelke. He's the president and founder of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. Derwood, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Very nice to be back. Thank you for having me.
So you were part of the 140 country negotiation process that signed the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol. Now, the Kigali Amendment is trying to phase down HFCs, or hydrofluorocarbons, but why don't we take a step back and why don't you tell us what the Montreal Protocol was with CFCs and your role in the Montreal Protocol, if you will.
Okay, well, the Montreal Protocol was designed to address the problem identified in 1974 by Mario Molina and Sherry Rowland, that CFCs were migrating to the upper atmosphere and destroying the protective stratospheric ozone layer. This was the first great threat to the global atmosphere. And the first response from the world was from chemical companies who made CFCs, who said that Mario Molina and Sherry Rowland were crackpot scientists who didn't know what they were talking about. They were diminished, they were demeaned, they were slandered, and later they won the Nobel Prize, of course. What they did was to identify a phenomena that, had we not stopped it, would have created a massive hole in the ozone layer that would have been permanent, would have resulted in massive numbers, millions and millions of cases of skin cancer, millions of deaths from those skin cancers, cataracts throughout the world, a suppression of the immune system, and even damage to the built environment. But because of their heroic work and because of the response of the policy community, led by the first director of UNEP, a great Egyptian scientist named Mustafa Tolba, the world came together to create the Montreal Protocol to protect the ozone layer. This agreement has evolved in its nearly 30-year history to be the best environmental treaty the world has ever created, the only one with universal membership. Every country that's a member of the UN is a party to this treaty. That's 197 countries. And it has done its main job of protecting the ozone layer, putting it back on the path for recovery in about 2065. We have empirical evidence that this is occurring, recently published by Susan Solomon just a couple of months ago. At the same time, the Montreal Protocol, unbeknownst to most people, has done more to protect the climate than any other single agreement. If you look at what we did starting in 1974, after we got the early warning from Molina and Roland, and we stopped using hairspray and underarm deodorant spray, and started boycotting these products, and then we had some national measures in the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and then the Montreal Protocol. But that combined effort, starting early, has avoided as much warming as presently caused by carbon dioxide. That's about 1.7 or more watts per square meter for those who know their metrics. So we not only solved the problem of the stratospheric ozone layer, we did a tremendous job on climate protection, which no one really noticed until 2007, maybe 2006, when the Federated States of Micronesia said, we are about to go under from sea level rise, and we need fast mitigation. Where can we find it? And they discovered the Montreal Protocol had done so much for already for climate, and they thought, why not have it do more? So in 2007, they proposed to accelerate the phase out of HCFCs, the current refrigerant of choice for most applications, and they succeeded. After that, which was a climate result that produced about 10 to 15 billion tons of CO2 equivalent, so several times the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, they decided that they thought this treaty should do more. So they looked at the HFCs and started a campaign. They did a formal proposal in 2009 with Mauritius, another island vulnerable to sea level rise, and with the country in North Africa of Morocco. And they've led the charge ever since. So there's been this drumbeat that's gotten louder and louder and louder, and that brought us to Kigali, Rwanda, for what we hoped was going to be an ambitious amendment that would capture what the scientists have told us is up to a half a degree Celsius of warming and take it out of the future.
So set the stage for us in Kigali, Rwanda, Durwood. What was your role in helping craft the Kigali Amendment ultimately?
The IGSD team went to Kigali to help a whole series of countries understand what the challenges were, how they might meet them, and come out winners. We've worked over the history of this effort, starting in 2006, to develop the science. And then we tried to bring our enthusiasm and our optimism that this could be done. And we were among those dancing in the aisle at the end. When we walked into the meeting, there were more than 100 countries demanding the fastest, most aggressive ambition from an amendment. We had John Kerry coming for two full days. We had more than 40 other ministers, as well as the president of Rwanda, who came to address us in the very beginning. So the stage was set, but we had challenges that we knew we had to overcome, because there were countries that still could not bring themselves to early ambition. They were concerned that if they committed to an early date, they might not be able to stay in compliance.
Let's talk about some of those challenges technologically and from a manufacturing standpoint. The biggest emitter of HFCs are air conditioning units, correct?
Yes, they're probably the single biggest sector.
The conundrum is that as the world is warming, more people need air conditioning. What is the replacement for the HFC-fueled air conditioning units?
There are many alternatives, but let me preface that by saying that when we first agreed to phase out CFCs by 50%, that was the first control measure of the Montreal Protocol, we didn't know what the alternatives were going to be. What we knew is that we had a hole in the ozone layer, and if we didn't fix it, the world was doomed to suffer great damage. So we drove with a precautionary approach the chemical companies and many others to come up with substitutes. That includes not in kind, so you don't always replace with new chemicals. In this case, we have, for almost all sectors, including air conditioning, very good alternatives.
Let me interject also, aren't the HFCs, they were actually part of that initial development as a response to the original Montreal Protocol, correct?
You are right again. The parties to the Montreal Protocol, I think, would not take the same course they took last time, which was to say, we're an ozone treaty, we're going to get rid of all the ozone depleting chemicals, but HFCs are fine for ozone, and we're not going to pay attention to the fact that they harm the climate. I think that's, you know, we all recognize that was not the best policy move. So in a sense, we opened the door to the HFCs, and it took us a seven-year battle to slam that door back shut, as we did in Kigali.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Durwood Zelke. He's the president and founder of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development in Washington, D.C. So at what point did people know that HFCs were harmful in a different way than CFCs, but still harmful to the environment?
Well, if you go back to, again, 1974, when Roland Molina said the fluorinated gases, CFCs, to start with, were damaging the, or rather destroying the ozone layer. The next year, Professor Ramanathan, who's now at Scripps at the University of California, San Diego, said, by the way, fluorinated gases are also super climate pollutants, so pay attention. But the work of Ramanathan and at that early stage was not followed the way it should be.
And climate change wasn't as widely accepted an idea or a science yet as well.
That's absolutely right. So the global warming was not appreciated as a problem.
So just to give an overview for our listeners, CFCs were causing holes in the ozone layer, and that because of the work that you and your colleagues did in Montreal, that is practically healed now. Now, the problem with the HFCs is not ozone related, but it's that it causes warming at a much greater rate than CO2. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly right. It's 10,000 times more powerful at warming the planet for many of the HFCs. So it's a super climate pollutant, meaning it's really potent in even small quantities.
Okay, so now pick up where you left off. I'm sorry to interrupt.
So we came to Kigali with the goal of capturing the half a degree Celsius to take it out of the system, and also to advance the improvements in energy efficiency of air conditioners and other appliances, because in a life cycle climate analysis, the energy efficiency that it takes, in a life cycle climate analysis, the energy it takes to run an air conditioner ends up being about 80 to 90% of the entire climate footprint. So we could not sacrifice efficiency when we were getting rid of HFCs. We wanted to make that absolutely clear. So we came in with a special fund of $80 million put together by the White House and several other countries that put in $27 million. And then a group of philanthropists, Bill Gates, John Doerr, a famous venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, and his wife, Anne, Tom Steyer, another well-known billionaire in California who's a strong environmental advocate, and a group of 16 foundations. And they put in $53 million focusing on energy efficiency challenge. So the parties made a compromise and they said, we will do not only the usual, which is to say, of course, the developed countries will go first and cap their production and consumption of HFCs in 2019. So that's a freeze date in 2019. You can't make or use more than what you do on that date. And then you start a phase down. And the developed country parties, called A2 countries, they agreed not only to do the freeze in 2019, but to take a 10% cut right then, so they'd only be producing 90%, and then to do a series of step downs over the next 30 years, approximately, to finish their phase down. We always have a grace period then before the developing countries have to act, and that allows the developed countries to develop and perfect the substitutes, drive them to scale, and drive down the price. So after this grace period, which in this case is 5 years, most of the developing countries have to start their phase down, including China.
So that's very different from the argument we often hear saying, well, the U.S. won't move until China moves because they're just as big in many ways as we are as an economy. But they're being treated as similar to the developing nations under the Montreal Protocol. Is that correct?
That's correct. So under the history of the Montreal Protocol, China remains in the developing country group.
And why is that important?
Well, it's the tradition, the history, and the law under the Montreal Protocol that developed countries always go first and developing countries always get a grace period before they have to start their freeze and then their eventual phase down of the chemicals. That has worked incredibly well for nearly 30 years, and this was not the moment to try to change that. The agreement that was struck is to have China and most of the other developing countries move to a freeze in 2024, so a short period of 5 years later, and then several years after that to start the actual phase down. But we also created a third group for the very first time, and this was the group that is, in a sense, the laggards who didn't have the confidence to know whether they could meet a more ambitious freeze date of 2024. So they said, we will move in from what we originally said of about 2030 to 2031, and we'll move in to 2028. Now, they're a small contributor to the problem right now, and having them in this laggards group does not reduce the climate benefits by any significant amount. In addition, what will happen is that the market transformation that the ambitious countries will drive will sweep along the laggards in a very graceful way because all the alternatives they need will be available much sooner than they expected at a reasonable price, and they'll be able to move into the more ambitious group. They'll recognize that in the next few years. I'm absolutely confident of that. And even if they didn't move, the market will move them, and the transition will occur even if they keep their insurance policy of the 2028 date. We also included in this amendment the agreement by all countries to capture and destroy an HFC that is a byproduct, HFC 23, another very potent gas that you get as you manufacture HCFC 22. And that is one of the dominant chemicals that's still being used. So this byproduct is very, very important. We get another 10 billion tons out of the destruction of the HFC 23. Then finally, we made energy efficiency an issue, not only with this fast start funding, but the parties took note of the need to develop more policy measures that can give a leg up to the energy efficiency during the transition. In the past phase outs of refrigerants, the manufacturers have always had to stop their production line and change refrigerants. And when they've done that, their engineers say, why don't we upgrade our compressor? There are new ones on the market, they don't cost anymore, and they're much more efficient. So they put those in. Let's upgrade. That's the single biggest user of energy, the compressor. then they'll say, why don't we upgrade our heat exchangers? There are new ones that are more efficient. So the catalytic effect of past amendments has driven improvements in efficiency by anywhere from 15% to up to 60% in some cases. So, but this time the parties are paying more attention. They want to be more deliberate in capturing the energy efficiency gains, because that could double the size of the climate prize going forward.
You mentioned the market. How do manufacturers respond? How will they adjust to these changing technological demands, Durwood?
Remember the history. First, the chemical companies absolutely denied any culpability in destroying the ozone layer and demonized the scientists. But as soon as we did the Montreal Protocol, the chemical companies said, oh, by the way, we have some good alternatives we're ready to offer you.
Which we've probably been sitting on for a decade.
Well, they came out pretty quickly, and they were extremely important in being able to get rid of the CFCs quickly. After that initial period, the chemical companies who make many of the substitutes that will be used have learned how to work in a much more efficient way with the regulatory structure of the Montreal Protocol. The Montreal Protocol sets the freezes, it sets the phase-down schedules, it sets the grace period. It provides certainty to the markets. We've negotiated this HFC amendment for several years. Actually, it started 7 years ago, but very seriously the last 3 years. Chemical companies have watched this carefully. They've started shifting their investment out of the high GWP HFCs into the climate-friendly substitutes that they're making. So the market transformation has been underway. Montreal Protocol locks in the transformation and puts it on steroids. The market transition is just going to rocket now. Keep an eye on the news, and you'll see over the coming weeks and months new substitutes being put on the market that have been developed for the last several years, and some, as you say, may have even been on the shelf just ready for the right market conditions. Remember, there are other substitutes we can use for coolants, including the natural refrigerants. You can use hydrocarbons in room air conditioners that are 1.5 tons or less. You go above that and you have some safety issues, but they're very very efficient and effective cooling system built on on the hydrocarbons. So that's a commodity. There's no intellectual property. It's not for those who are worried that some of the new substitutes might be expensive. Sometimes they are expensive, but usually that's a price absorbed by the developed countries, and by the time the developing countries have to act, those prices have come down, either because of the scale or because the intellectual property has expired. So we expect that to be the same pattern going forward with this Kigali Amendment.
Invitations in, it beats out, get out and do it again. Less than blessing down, put it to shame. Only gonna do you blind. Whole lot of folks can't see that high. We've been walking on air, y'all. Been walking on air. We've been walking on air, y'all. Been walking on air. We've been walking on air, y'all. Been walking on air.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Durwood Zelke. He's the president and founder of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development in Washington, D.C. So we've talked about the 140 governments agreeing to the Kigali Amendment, and we've just discussed what some of the technological hurdles will be for the chemical companies and manufacturers. But now let's turn to compliance. How will we make sure that everyone abides by the Kigali Amendment, Durwood?
Well, first of all, the 140 countries of the world who were in Kigali have reached an agreement that will bind all 197 countries. so that those who are not there will be bound by this mandatory treaty. So unlike Paris, which is a brilliant agreement but built on pledges that each individual country makes and says they will comply with, the Montreal Protocol has a rigorous compliance system that starts with what we would call a get-well program.
Is the Paris Agreement completely distinct from the Montreal Protocol? Is there any overlap in terms of logistics and organizing?
Well, the Montreal Protocol is a sister agreement that has just provided the single biggest down payment in the history of the world by taking out a half a degree of warming. No other single act has ever done anything close to that much for the climate. The emissions of HFCs will continue to be governed by the Paris Agreement because Montreal Protocol wisely regulates upstream production and consumption. That's what the Montreal Protocol does. So it says there are only so many factories that make these gases. Let's regulate them instead of trying to regulate every emission from every air conditioner. We can't do that. So the emissions will stay over in the, and the reporting requirements for emissions will stay in the Paris Agreement. These are two fundamentally different agreements, however. Paris is the is a foundational agreement that by that includes all countries in their pledges. But it's an agreement that is somewhat different than the mandatory treaty that the Montreal Protocol is. Montreal Protocol is the hardest treaty law that the world is capable of creating. So if you are out of compliance, you have to first go to the non-compliance committee.
And who determines that they're out of compliance?
They self-report that they're out of compliance. Always done this. We have phased out nearly 100 chemicals by nearly 100%, which is measured regularly in the atmosphere. So we know that we're taking these 100 chemicals out of the system. That means that the 197 countries in the Montreal Protocol have been in near perfect compliance for the history of this treaty. But there have been occasions when countries have gone out of compliance. They go to the compliance committee, and the committee says, what do you need? Let's help you get into compliance. Do you need technical support? Do you need us to show you how to get rid of this or that or to transition into something new? And if parties come back into compliance, they're forgiven. But if they deliberately fail to come into compliance, this has only happened once, then they are threatened with the loss of the privileges of the treaty, which includes access to the dedicated funding mechanism called the Multilateral Fund, which has provided more than $3.5 billion to the parties to stay in compliance. So you lose that. And then finally, you're subject to trade measures if you don't come into compliance. That was threatened once in the history of this treaty, and that party came back into compliance. So the backup threat of these powerful sanctions is important, but the Get Well program has kept everybody pretty much in compliance throughout the history of the treaty.
Durwood Zelke, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Martin Medeski and Wood, Pink Floyd, and Mofro. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.